Now, I'd like to move to a somewhat different area, although I think there's probably a relationship. What about secured debt, let's say mortgages and other loans? What, if anything, of what we've been discussing applies there, or what are the differences?
We've not had much direct success at mortgages, despite the fact that they are so flagrantly criminal in Canada. If you look at your mortgage, there's two different types. The first type is where they state right on the face of it, I, John Smith, being registered as owner of an estate in fee simple of the following lands, and in consideration of the sum of $100,000, the receipt of which is hereby acknowledged. You got to stop for a second and ask yourself, when I signed that document at the lawyer's, when it was signed, witnessed, and notarized, were those statements in fact true? And in fact, they were not true in the majority of cases. In virtually all cases, what you want the so-called loan for is to acquire the property. You're buying a new place. Then you're not the registered owner at the time that you signed the document. And in virtually every case where it's a new mortgage, the bank has not given you any money yet. And in fact, they cannot give you any money yet because they don't have it yet, because your mortgage security instrument is in fact the loan money itself. And in order to be functional as a promissory note or as a bill of exchange under the Bills of Exchange Act, the document must have the appearance of an unconditional promise to pay. And in order to be an unconditional promise to pay, it must appear as though they've already given you the loan so as they can use the security instrument as a receipt.
Let me go back just a moment, because there was an important point that you mentioned quickly. The document that you are signing is itself the funding instrument of the loan of the mortgage which you are about to take on. So you have, in fact, through your signature, created the funds which you're about to borrow. That's confusing. Can you explain that a little bit?
I was in Kelowna 2 weekends ago, and I was speaking to a fellow who did exactly this. He used his own mortgage to pay for the property. He went out, and he issued a mortgage directly to the vendor of the property, and he purchased it for the mortgage. The mortgage is money on its face. For example, it was about a $200,000 property, and he issued the mortgage directly to the vendor, and it said, I promise to pay the vendor, and secured it by the property. It obligated him at 7% to pay, I think it was about $1,400 a month for the next 25 years, so as to call for a total of $420,000 for a $200,000 mortgage. What he's doing is he is hypothecating or pledging his expected future income stream of $420,000 in exchange for the privilege of creating $200,000 today for the purchase of a $200,000 market value property. The document registered at the land registry, it is the money. And when you give that to a bank instead of the vendor, the bank acts as the so-called middleman, as far as you know, but that isn't what really happens. The bank writes down in its own books that it received from you $200,000, and then it issues a new credit to the vendor for $200,000. But that credit that it issues costs it nothing to produce. It's zero, costless provision of credit. And at that moment that you hypothecate your income to that instrument, there is an actual and literal increase in purchasing power of $200,000 in the Canadian economy. So what happens is the bank tricks you into giving it to them as a gift or on the pretense that it's mere security, when in fact it is the funding instrument. They write on their own books, we received from the so-called borrower $200,000 of money or money equivalent. They don't even make a distinction between it. It's as if you gave them cash. They then issue the credit to the vendor. And at that point, that's where the $200,000 increase in purchasing power, the equity behind it, is taken from your account and put into the bank's own personal account. That's the point at which your equity is scooped.
And when you say from your account, the promise to pay and the signing of the document creates this new money. So which account is it coming out of?
It's creating new present value money. Let's say that you are a steel worker or a millwright or what have you, such that you can expect over the course of your lifetime to make $1 million through 40 years of hard labor. And over that 40-year period, you are now in this situation that I just described. You're taking $420,000 of that total lifetime capacity, and you are trading it for $200,000 today, and you're bringing it forward to the present from the future. Okay, so it's not really creating money so much as shifting it from one time frame to another, but you don't get credit for that. You have to give it to the bank as a gift, and they get the equitable credit for it.
So now in this case where the purchaser wrote the mortgage and gave it directly to the vendor without the bank in between, How is that money or value transferred to the vendor?
Well, the vendor receives an account credit from the bank, which they then reassign to somebody else. You've heard the expression, the difference between paying a debt and discharging it? Okay, it's like John owes Tom $100,000, so he says, well, Bob owes me $100,000, so why doesn't Bob just pay Tom? Nothing has been paid. All you've done is to reassign the liability, and that's all the banks ever do, but it's within the frame of reference or the context of a bubble that is ever expanding. Well, no debt is ever paid. It's only reassigned or discharged. Assume that you take $1,000 to the bank and you make a deposit. Okay, the moment you make that deposit, the property interest in the currency, the, say, Federal Reserve notes or the Canadian currency from the Bank of Canada, it passes to the bank. It's now the bank's property. Now, run the same scenario through your mind with $1 million and a billion, and that someone in the country inherits $1 billion from somebody outside the country, and they take it down to the bank and make a deposit. Okay, the moment they do so, the bank is $1 billion richer than it was the instant before. Then the bank issues $1 billion credit back to the person who made the deposit. At that point, there is $1 billion increase in the total amount of purchasing power in society. Because what we're constantly confusing is a deposit for what is technically a reposit. You've heard the term repository?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. As opposed to a depository. With a repository, the property interest in the money stays with the person who makes the reposit. It's like a safety deposit box, which is actually, of course, a safety reposit box. It still remains to be your money. And the cost to you is outstanding. You could virtually eliminate the federal income tax, and all the government has to do is insist that the banks actually have the money that they owe people. The point is that when you go down and you make a deposit and the bank issues a new instrument called an account credit in the same amount, then at that point, there is an increase in the money supply. And that's where all this inflation is coming from. Before the deposit, let's say that we're dealing with $1 million. You find $1 million in gold or something, or cash even, and you take it down to the bank. Before the deposit, there's $1 million that you own and can spend. Fairly straightforward. After the deposit, relatively speaking, there's $1 million that the bank now owns and can spend if it wants to, and there is $1 million account credit that you own and you can spend if you want to. There has, on its face, been an increase of $1 million in purchasing power supply, and that happens every time a deposit is made. And that is the point at which our system is revealed to be a constructive fraud against equity. The fact that property interest in the real money passes from the depositor to the bank in exchange for a consideration that costs the bank nothing to produce. You fix that problem, you fix the whole world.
This raises two questions. You're paying off a mortgage and times are tight and you can't make your payments, and then you're in a situation where if you start missing payments, you could be subject to foreclosure. Is there, based on the information we've been talking about, a strategy, a remedy to undo some kind of hidden fraud which has been in existence that you didn't know about up until this time?
It's essentially the same as it was for the unsecured debt, only you have to go about it in a little bit different way. You must confront them with it and demand that they explain their actions, and it depends on the nature of your paper, so to speak. As I said, there are two ways they can do this. The one is the categorically false statement on the face of the mortgage that you've already received the money. That's an offense under Section 388 of the Criminal Code. It's a constructive forgery. The other possibility, and which is becoming increasingly prevalent, is that they will state on the face of the mortgage that in exchange for their bare agreement to loan you $100,000, you agree to give them the $100,000 in the form of the mortgage security. And then they loan it back to you, your own money, but they call it a loan, and you have to pay it back again, plus interest. Now, in that case, you've got what is called a fictitious consideration on the face of the mortgage. The bank has to make a declaration under its annual reports that it recognizes that its bare agreement to loan is not a good and valuable consideration in and of itself. The only thing a borrower ever wants is the money, and that's the only thing of value that a bank ever provides in theory. So you've got a contract that states on its face, and they always follow it up with, neither the execution nor registration of this mortgage shall bind the bank to advance the principal amount, but you agree that you owe us the $200,000 or the $100,000 anyway. And so you've got a fictitious consideration, a contract that states on its face, you agree that we've done nothing for you, and in return, you agree that you owe us all this money. It's a phony contract on its face. There's a process that you can go through. It's very difficult and dicey when you're dealing with a chartered bank due to the existence of Section 434, Subsection 2 of the Bank Act, that is retroactive legislation, and it says, to paraphrase, Nothing in any act, charter, or law shall be construed as preventing a bank from acting on any power of sale contained in any mortgage document held by the bank. So it says no power in the universe can stop a bank from foreclosing on a mortgage. But the flaw in that is that if it is a constructive forgery, then it isn't a mortgage in law. And so they wouldn't be able to act on that. What you're dealing with there is you've got evidence right staring you in the face. There's no competent government acting in good faith would ever enact such a law that says nothing in any act, charter, or law, including the Constitution itself, can stop a bank from realizing on a mortgage. On its face, that law is invalid. But what it does demonstrate is if you're going to do this, you have to do it in groups. Don't try and do it on your own. Get together with 10 other people in the same boat and attack the problem as a group collectively. 30 people would be better, 50 is even better still. But if you go in by yourself, they're going to see that you're vulnerable and they're going to pick you off one way or another. And when these things go to court, especially with land mortgages, what happens is that I have never, ever seen the bank win. Every single case always ends with the court picking off your defenses one at a time. You can't raise this defense, you can't raise this defense, and you can't raise this defense. Therefore, the bank wins by default. The bank always wins by default. And it's a complex question, but there are remedies out there.
I misunderstood something you just said, where you said you've never seen the bank win.
No, I've never seen the bank win outright.
Win outright, right. But by default,
it's always
by eliminating your defenses.
Right, if you think of it as a hockey game or a soccer match, the other team, the borrower, is always disqualified.
I see. But
because the bank is incapable of scoring any goals. Okay. It can only have you disqualified, and it wins by default. And that's taken me 10 years to learn, but it's becoming increasingly manifest, and there are ways to exploit it.
In the long run, it looks like there might be as effective a remedy in the case of the mortgage, but it's still in process of being perfected.
Yes. One potential way to go about this, and this has just occurred to me in the last couple of weeks, is that a third party could be given a mortgage. And then if that third party, say you've got a technical forged mortgage, constructive forgery in law for $100,000 on your property. Well, you give your neighbor John a $100,000 second mortgage, and then John can go to the courts and make application as a third party with an interest in your property to have the bank's mortgage stricken as a fraudulent instrument. It would have to be done in a certain way. But the thing is that, you see, the third party, essentially you're doing the same thing as under the Bills of Exchange Act. The Bills of Exchange Act only deals with commercial paper. Who is a holder in due course and who is entitled to it without notice of defect and all of this other stuff? They don't care about the equities involved. The point is that I have a right to this property. My mortgage is good because it tells the truth. Your mortgage, Mr. Banker, is a constructive forgery because it contains an objectively false statement and a material false statement on its face that you had already given the money when you hadn't. And therefore, I am entitled in equity to have your mortgage stricken and mine put in its stead. That is the process that I'm working on right now. It's a little premature just yet, but in theory, that is the remedy that you're entitled to.
To conclude this, what I've learned is that in both secured and unsecured debt, essentially what you're doing is you're holding the banks responsible for the language which they have created on the instruments which they've asked you to sign. So you're not tricking them, you're untricking yourself.
Yes, exactly. Essentially, now look at it this way. When you make that false statement on the mortgage that you've already received the money from the bank, who is making that false statement? Is it the banker or is it you? See, it's you that's making the false statement because it's your paper. You are issuing that security as a false receipt for money already had and received. So what the bank is doing technically is requiring that you falsify the documents so that technically your hands are dirty and you can't raise that as an issue when you go to court. So what you have to do is you have to throw everything down on the table and argue equity from the outset. You don't ever want to argue law with these people because the courts have to give you equity if you argue equity. And so there's a way to do that. It sounds real simple here, but you have to know what you're doing and you have to be able to go in and say, I don't care what the mortgage says. This is equity. I want an equitable accounting of this transaction. Who brought the money to the transaction? And in fact, it's the borrower. The bank arrived at the transaction with nothing and walked away with $200,000. So if there is an audit of the equities, the bank will always lose. And if the bank loses the audit of the equities, the courts can't help them because they put nothing into it. They're not entitled to take anything away.